Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Vulture capitalists, that's what the Denver Post's lead editorial last Sunday called a hedge fund owner that happens to be its boss. The Chicago Tribune's newsroom is unionizing against its corporate boners. Sure, the news industry is facing challenges, but a growing number of journalists openly say that their ownership is harvesting outsized profits from what has long served as a civic good. This hour, On Point, local news, who owns it, and the future of news. You can join us on air or online. Has your local paper disappeared? Does it affect you? Where do you turn now for news? Join us anytime on onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Last Sunday, the Denver Post openly rebelled against the hedge fund Alden Global Capital, which owns it. It published numerous op-eds written by current and former staff members about the cuts that the 125-year-old newspaper is facing, many of them calling for Alden to sell the paper. Here's how Mark Stewart, a reporter at local ABC affiliate Denver 7, characterized it.
The timing is far from an accident. In fact, by the end of the day, 24 journalists will leave the Post, many of the victims of layoffs. So in a fearless move, the editorial page editor made a public plea, hoping the hedge fund that owns the paper now will show a commitment to journalism or sell it to someone who will.
Joining me now from Denver, Colorado, is that very editorial page editor who led the charge. It's Chuck Plunkett of the Denver Post. You can link to his April 6th editorial headlined "As Vultures Circle, the Denver Post Must Be Saved." That you can find that at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks so much for joining me today, Chuck.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for having me on.
So what prompted this this act? You've gotten national headlines out of it. You clearly wanted to have a local impact. But what finally was the straw that made you set off the flare gun and try to get their attention?
Well, it's the cuts. Before the cuts were announced, we were at about 100 journalists in our newsroom. We had at our, not so long ago, we'd had as many as 250. And over the years, things had declined. And, you know, we're a city of 700,000, a metro area of about 3 million, and when I thought about the prospect of trying to do quality journalism to serve those readers with, you know, fewer than 70 reporters or journalists, it was just appalling to me. And I thought something had to be done. And so we took our platform and put it out there so that people would know what was going on.
And not miss it. I mean, the front of that cover section, as well as your website, had a number of offerings, all hammering the point home, but from different perspectives and outlooks. I want to incorporate a couple of listeners who have posted things, one on our website. Josh posts, "What's the point of newspapers anymore? Everything printed is just parroted from the AP or Reuters, local news streams to any one of several devices from the time one gets out of bed in the morning more efficiently than the paperboy can deliver. And there are much more environmentally friendly ways to do a Sudoku." Meanwhile, Barry Wythoff, I hope I'm getting that name right, posted on Facebook, "It is a real problem. Ad revenue just keeps declining, and without trustworthy sources to gather the information in the first place and to do investigative reporting, citizens will be blind. Bloggers and cable news outlets only comment on stories developed by others and," Barry argues, "fabricate some of their own." Chuck, why don't you walk us through the kind of role that the Post plays and has played in recent years? What kind of light does it shine? What kind of accountability does it provide for the people of Colorado and the people of Greater Denver?
Well, in 2013, we won the Pulitzer Prize for breaking news coverage of the Aurora Theater shooting. I was the politics editor prior to joining the editorial page as the editor. Mm-hmm. And we're a political swing state, and we've had, we offer debates so that you can see the political race, see the candidates in their own flesh and blood, speaking live, covering the state house, all those kinds of things. We want the readers to know that we're an important public institution that tries to hold government accountable and speaks truth to power and gives voice to the voiceless.
You described in the editorial, in some of the accompanying material, a world in which you could imagine, you know, I think Gregory Moore, your former editor-in-chief who resigned a year or two ago after basically saying he was fed up with having to put cuts into place for corporate owners, you almost told readers they might have to envision a day where there wasn't a Denver Post. What kinds of news would people not know about? What kinds of activities would occur in your city, in your home area, that they might learn about? After all, there are other news outlets. We just heard from a reporter from ABC Channel 4. Presumably there are other channels there, other sites. You know, why would it be such a loss?
Well, the Denver Post goes to a lot of trouble to invest in an investigative team and good political coverage. Right now, Denver is looking at, it's a candidate for a second Amazon headquarters. We are considering a bid for the Winter Olympics in 2026 or 2030. Mm-hmm. 100,000 people have moved here since Alden took control of the Denver Post, and we're a boom town. We've got all kinds of issues like gentrification, affordable housing issues. There's a scandal at the mayor's office right now about him sending sexually inappropriate texts to a member of his security detail. You need the kinds of reporters who can be all over those stories. You need to be all over the Olympic bid. Who are the special interests that are trying to line up and profit from that? What's going on with the Amazon bid? Same question. Are developers inappropriately getting zoning changes or inappropriately doing things in neighborhoods, or is it all above board? Readers need to believe that there is someone minding the store. Now, certainly local TV and radio and other smaller outlets or other different kinds of media than we are able to do those kinds of things. But traditionally, the newspaper, the public, you know, the local paper has been the newsroom of record that people look to for those kinds of that kind of coverage,
providing a lot of the horsepower of local journalism. Joining our conversation now from Chicago is Dalene Galanton. She's a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. She recently won the 2018 American Society of News Editors Award for commentary and column writing. She was a Pulitzer finalist a couple years ago. Thanks for joining me, Dalene.
Thanks for having me, David.
You know, Dalene is also a member of the organizing committee of the fledgling Chicago Tribune Guild. NPR this week broke news that the Tribune Company newsroom, many of the folks in there, including four Pulitzer winners among your colleagues, were seeking to form a union. It has a rich tradition, both in terms of its corporate practices and in terms of its editorial line on the editorial pages of being anti-union. Dalene, why did it seem important at this time for you guys to say, we've got to form a union, we've got to have our own voice in a more public way?
Well, David, as you probably know, the Tribune has been going through years of uncertainty. We've faced so many layoffs. We've lost so many wonderful colleagues who've left because the pay has not been competitive at the Tribune, and we know that we face losing more of that. We felt as though the future of this paper and the way we cover this city depended on our ability to step up and have a place in those conversations, and we felt as though a union would give us that opportunity.
You know, there have been years of cuts at the Chicago Tribune. It's owned by what's now called Tronc. It is a sister paper of the Los Angeles Times, although that's in the process of being sold off to a billionaire down there in Los Angeles. It's also sister paper of the Baltimore Sun, where I worked for more than a decade, of the Hartford Courant, of a couple papers in Florida of distinction. What are the kinds of stories in Chicago that you guys have been unable to get to in a way that you think, or kinds of issues you haven't been able to take on in a more meaningful way as a result of the cuts over time? I think at one point your newsroom was something like, forgive me if it's a little off, but 670 journalists, and it's now down to something a little over 200.
Yes, yes. Well, I want to first say that I think that the journalists who are there have been doing a fantastic job with the resources that we have to cover the city. As you know, we have a fantastic watchdog group, and we cover politics in the city like no one else. The violence is a major issue in Chicago. I think we are also in the forefront of that coverage here in the city. However, there are certain things that we simply don't have the staff to cover. For instance, there used to be a time when we covered public housing. We covered things like social services. We don't have those staffs anymore, so some of those things are not covered as fully as they possibly could be if we had more staff. So as the city changes and because we're such a diverse city, I just believe that we could do a better job if we had a staff that, number one, was more diverse, more racially and ethnically diverse, because I think that brings a better understanding to a lot of the issues that we're facing here in Chicago.
Briefly, that to me sounds like a very important thing for any newsroom, but it's an important thing for a well-stocked newsroom with plenty of money. Not all newsrooms have been particularly successful in that very regard. It seems to me as though you and Chuck in some ways are describing a world in which, you know, you're not getting to yet, but are nearing something of a time where we might fear the existence of these institutions, but also something of a news desert. Where do you think people in Chicago could turn to news in the about 45 seconds we have left if you guys weren't, you know, holding the torch and taking the charge when it came to holding things and people accountable?
Unfortunately, David, there would be a news desert. You know, the Chicago Tribune, nobody can cover the city the way we do. If we were not there, there would be so many things that are going on with the violence in our city that our readers just absolutely would not know about. We feel like we could do that better. And that's what we aim to do by forming this union.
We're discussing local newspapers and their struggle for survival as they balance mission and profits. Chuck Plunkett of the Denver Post, Darlene Glanton of the Chicago Tribune, please stay with us. We'd like the rest of you listening to join the conversation. What do you value in your local newspapers? Have shifts in ownership affected the news you consume? We're interested in hearing your thoughts. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about newspaper newsrooms calling foul on their own owners, saying profit goals are too extreme, the public service too damaged. We'll explore whether what news may never see the light of day. And we'll explore whether increased consolidation in the news business has played a role, whether in newspapers or in local TV, as in the controversy over Sinclair Broadcast. You can join the conversation. Do you still rely on your local paper? Do you still trust it? Where would you get your news if it went away? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking today to Chuck Plunkett. He's the editorial page editor of the Denver Post. And to Darlene Glanton. She's columnist for the Chicago Tribune and a member of its union organizing committee. They're hoping to get a union formed and recognized there. I first want to, before we go back, go to the phones. We've got some interesting calls. People clearly very invested in this topic. Let's go first to line two. Heather's calling from Asheville, North Carolina. Welcome, Heather.
Hi, David. This is a very timely topic for us here in Asheville because we had our Asheville police beat an unarmed black man. Nobody would have known about it if somebody in the police department had not leaked that footage weeks after the event to our local newspaper, and that sparked public outcry. And currently, our police department is under federal investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And this direct coverage has been, you know, because the newspaper took up the cause, it has been the catalyst for change for us.
Heather, thank you for that insight and that call. Not only was it leaked to somewhere, but it was leaked to somewhere that could do additional reporting. Sean is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Sean, tell us your experience with the newspaper.
Hi, David and guests. Yes, I've been reading the Detroit Free Press since 1996, and it has been a great source of information all these years. And it's just really sad to see the decline of this paper that's been around for over 180 years, I believe. And ever since, I'm not sure if it was U.S. Today or Gannett that purchased it, it has literally become a pamphlet. And here in Metro Detroit, but especially in Detroit, we're on the rise. And at this time, we need some oversight. And the paper, for instance, was helped take down Kwame Kilpatrick and won a Pulitzer Prize for Stephen Henderson.
He was the former mayor there, Stephen Henderson, an old colleague of mine.
Yeah. And he did a fantastic job, Stephen Henderson. And it's just very sad to see this thing that was a part of my life every single day. I've literally had to go, which I was going to anyway, but to the New York Times to get my news every day. I would just like a local perspective, especially here in Detroit. I think we deserve it.
Thank you so much, Sean, from Detroit, Michigan. I want to make clear we offered the opportunity to Alden Global Capital and Digital First Media. They're the owners of the Denver Post to reply to our request for comment. They did not do so. Tronc is the parent company of the Chicago Tribune. It turned down our request, but they did pass along a memo sent out to colleagues at the Chicago Tribune on April 11th in response to the revelation that a union was in the process of being at least attempted to be formed. Bruce Dold is the editor and publisher. He struck a relatively benign tone, I would say, in reading this. He said, they have the utmost respect for the decisions you make and for your rights on this issue. We believe in transparency, open dialogue, and fairness. That's who we are as journalists and what guides the Tribune. He also talked about sharing the concerns that union organizers had raised about compensation, cost of benefits, staff diversity, and other things, and that they hope to continue efforts to make their jobs competitive with other journalism jobs. I will say at your, Darlene, at your sister company, the Los Angeles Times, a number of executives were moved from the LA Times, including the editor-in-chief, including the publisher, after what seemed to be certain kinds of internal newsroom mutinies against him and a union organizing effort that proved successful there in mid-January. What is it that you guys are looking to achieve by unionizing?
What we basically want, David, is a seat at the table. We believe that we deserve an opportunity to be heard, that we deserve an opportunity to speak about the future of this company and how it relates to us as employees. We basically want the company to recognize us as not just contributors to this organization, but the backbone of this organization. And when you're the backbone of an organization, you need to have a place at the table. And we haven't had that. And it's really interesting. And I do believe that the editors at the Tribune have had an open-door policy where we could go in and talk about things. But it doesn't take it far enough. It's one thing to listen, and it's another thing to actually act on the things that you're hearing.
It also,
and that's what we want.
It also sounds, Darlene and Chuck, as though there's not the editors may have a local door policy, but a lot of them, you've seen wave after wave of editors step down after declining. They just had one too many rounds of cutbacks, and that they aren't in control of their own destiny. Chuck Plunkett, if you think about the investment fund that owns you guys, have they articulated to you any sort of positive vision about the role they think journalism plays and the way in which this investment is part of a belief in that as opposed to an investment offsetting, as has been reported by Bloomberg and other places, certain declines they've experienced in other investments?
No, and that's been the problem. There, we don't have a sense of mission coming from the ownership. If anything, we have a conflicting set of messages. We downsized and moved our entire news operation to the printing plant at the beginning of the year. And we were told that that would create cost savings sufficient to put us on track, that we wouldn't have to worry about newsroom cuts for the next year or two. Right around that time, we launched a paywall to try to start making money online so that we could prepare for the future. At that point in time, it seemed like that was a positive move from the company, and it made sense to us. We were starting to get subscriptions at a faster rate than some of our peers had done when they launched paywalls. And we believed for a time that we had hit bottom, that maybe we finally were in a place where we could start doing good journalism again and not be under constant threat of cuts. And then kind of out of the blue, before the bulk of the newsroom even made it into the printing plant, our publisher resigned. Mm-hmm. And within weeks, we find out about these massive cuts that are going to degrade the brand, including digital producers. Why do you launch a paywall, which is going to depend in its initial launch in convincing readers that they need to pay money to access your content online?
It's a change in the understanding that you have with your audience, right?
It doesn't make any sense. And so when you read the media experts like Ken Doctor and what have you saying that this is just a cynical bid to lay off reporters faster than subscribers notice, you realize that we really are facing an existential crisis, that within 2 or 3 years, our brand is going to be so diminished that when the hedge fund finally sells us, we're not going to be worth resurrecting. The brand is going to be too diminished in the eyes of our readers, and that is just a deplorable state of affairs.
An existential crisis. You know, I think people can look at corporate ownership and see good and bad. We had a caller from Asheville a few minutes ago who talked about her Gannett Corporation-owned newspaper and their good coverage of the police brutality allegations. Our caller then subsequently from Detroit, Michigan, talking about the collapse of the Detroit Free Press, also owned by the Gannett Company. There are green shoots. I just received a tweet from Berkeleyside. It's an independent news site in Berkeley, California. They just signed up. They made an appeal to their readers, asked them to become investors, and they got $1 million from those readers. That's a nice green shoot. On the other hand, I don't know that the Berkeleyside would even itself claim that it could replace, you know, the San Francisco Chronicle or the Oakland Tribune, both of which, particularly in Oakland, have had some real cuts in local years. We've got some callers on the line. This is attracting some passion from folks. Let's go first, I think, to line one. Winston is calling from Noonan, Georgia. Winston, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, David. I'm the news editor at a locally owned daily paper, a family-owned paper going back 4 generations.
Tell us the name of your paper.
It's the Noonan Times Herald.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in what's now a suburb of Atlanta. And I think what I'm seeing in our news organization is that because this family has this legacy, there's a commitment to having good local news coverage. And so when we've had our share of cuts, but we're always looking at, okay, how do we serve the readers and how do we cover things that nobody else is going to cover?
Chuck Plunkett, I want to talk a little bit about the question of consolidation, and that happens in the news side. Digital First owns a ton of outlets. Can you remind us of some of your sister newspapers that have been absorbed and incorporated in recent years to your company?
Sure. I mean, look in the Bay Area, the Mercury News. At one time, that area with the papers had more than 400 journalists, and it's down now to, I think, less than 100. There's also the Pioneer Press in Minneapolis, and they just bought the Boston Herald. So it's from coast to coast. Digital First Media and Alden Capital have upwards of 100 papers in the United States.
You know, there's been consolidation on local news on the TV side as well. This came into the news of late. I think a number of folks have heard about about the must run, as it was called, an editorial statement that was an edict was given from folks at Sinclair Broadcast Group outside Baltimore, Maryland, that the local anchors on all of their news teams had to read these statements decrying the state of the news business and saying they could be trusted as a source of reliable news. The striking thing to me in some ways as somebody who covered this controversy was that not only did they, without naming names, essentially pour cold water on the viability of other news organizations as trustful sources, but they also made it seem as though these were personal statements, that these were epiphanies and observations these local anchors had come to on their own and traded on. Timothy Burke, the video editor for the sports news and blogs website Deadspin, spliced together footage of anchors at the Sinclair stations, dozens of them, many dozens of them across the country, reading the exact same statement on fake news. And here's what the sound of what that video collage sounded like earlier this month.
Some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false
news has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
A Deadspin collage proving the point in some ways of the homogeneity of local news and apparently of local epiphanies as well with increasing corporate ownership. I wanted to go to a former Sinclair reporter, a cut that he offered in speaking last Sunday with CNN's Brian Stelter. Jonathan Beaton had been a reporter at WPEC-TV that Sinclair owned. Beaton is now, it's important to say, in a legal battle with the company. But he talked about how the company, which is run by owned by four brothers outside Baltimore who are quite conservative in outlook, and how the company affects the news that some of their viewers see at their stations across the country.
With Sinclair, what makes this so insidious is they focus on small to mid-sized markets throughout the U.S., from Macon, Georgia to Bozeman, Montana. And they focus on the person who works 12, 14 hours a day, comes home, maybe catches the last 15 minutes of the 6 o'clock news. And then they feed, you know, whatever conservative bias they have. And then also infects journalists because they tell you what stories you can or can't do and what angles you must take.
You know, Sinclair does focus on a lot of these markets over time, but they're also in the process of applying to take over the stations of what's called Tribune Media. It would add another 30-plus stations. Sinclair also already owns or controls about 190 stations across the country, by far the largest, and they've adopted a fairly Trump administration-friendly line, even as they're seeking approval from the Trump administration for this. Chuck Plunkett, what do you see in the controversy that swirled around Sinclair and how it affects how you think about the local news that people receive on the air?
Well, local news is so important, and in the last several years, reporters have all moved to the big coastal areas. There's been studies that show the hollowing out of newsrooms can actually even affect voting. Less information at the local level leads to less voter turnout. It leads to people not understanding their own neighbors. It leads to these caricatures that have led to the belief now that media news needs to come from some kind of like political perspective. We keep getting blamed for our demise on not understanding what's going on in the community, and that's because we've been hollowed out. And when you see a company directing ideological content like that all across the land, that leads to this echo chamber reality that we now live in that is just terrible for democracy.
Darlene, as you think about this, as you think about the way in which ownership is structured, you know, it's got to be possible for corporate owners to take profit. I mean, these are for-profit entities and still serve the customers. You know, folks at the Tribune are doing some very fine journalism. Are they doing it in concert with management? Are they doing it because of the structure provided? Or are they doing it despite the pressures that are loaded from above?
I think at this point, what we've gotten to at the Tribune is the core. And I think the people who are here now are people who are there because they want to be and because, you know, they love this paper and they love this city. I do think that now, you know, I also think that we make a distinction, too, between corporate and our local leadership. For the most part, we get a lot of support from the editors, which are in the Tribune Tower. They have been involved in leading the coverage, and many of them have done a very good job with that. It's the corporate folks who don't always seem to get it. We basically have no relationship with them, and there are, you know, the dictates coming down that we don't understand.
Well, so complicated. Questions for news. The Chicago Tribune, of course, moving out of that historic Tribune Tower. We've been talking to Darlene Glanton. She's columnist for the Tribune, member of its union organizing committee. Darlene, thank you so much for taking time to explore these issues.
Thank you.
Chuck Plunkett is editorial page editor of Denver Post. At least he still is right now. Thank you so much for joining me and describing what made you make the remarkable section last Sunday. One person who has not given up on local newspaper is our own On Point producer, Brian Amaral. Today's his last day with us as he heads off to the Providence Journal. We wish him all the best. Salute to you. When we come back, we'll talk to a married couple who were severely injured in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Are you funnier than Fallon? More amusing than Aziz? More clever than Click and Clack? Well, if you've got an idea that'll make people laugh, enter WBUR's Next Great Show contest for a chance to get your show on the air. To find out more, go to wbur.org/nextgreatshow.
I'm On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point. Jessica Kensky and Patrick Downs were newlyweds cheering at the finish of the Boston Marathon in 2013 when the bombs went off. Patrick lost his left leg, Jessica too, and later her right leg was amputated. During a years-long recovery, she got a service dog named Rescue, who's helped her not just physically but emotionally. The couple are here today in studio, with Rescue, of course, to talk about their new children's book called Rescue and Jessica, A Life-Changing Friendship. You can join the conversation. Do you have a service animal who has transformed your life? Was there an unexpected way you were able to negotiate past an unthinkable trauma? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Jessica Kensky and Patrick Downs, along with Rescue, thank you all three for joining me today in studio.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, thank you.
Before we talk specifically about the book, you guys went through what for many people would be, even though it plays out on television, unthinkable. And you describe a little bit and even in the illustration depict a bit a dark place for what you guys went through. How did you guys decide after time apart, after years of healing, how did you find your way to working through this trauma?
We had to work really hard. We're still working hard. I think we'll be working on this for the rest of our lives. We spent a lot of time talking with each other, with therapists, both individually and as a couple, processing it with our families who were there in those first moments, meeting the people who cared for us, both on Boylston Street and then in the hospitals. We've forged incredible bonds with our Boylston Street family. We lived at Walter Reed in Bethesda, Maryland for 3 years. And
they have really hard-won knowledge on how to deal with injuries like this.
They do, and the psychological element of it as well. And we've found incredible kinship with all these different groups of people. So that's been very healing for us, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Your story has been depicted in movies and documentaries. I think a lot of people sort of assume there's an epiphany moment. You kind of figure it out and you work through it. My sense is that's not how it works in real life.
No, not at all. That would be nice, though.
You'd volunteer for that.
Yeah, I would. I would. No, I think Patrick hit the nail on the head. It's a lifelong thing that we're struggling with. And we have hit new plateaus, new peaks, which has been great. We just moved home back to the Boston area last summer, and it took about 4.5 years before I stopped having surgery on a regular basis and kind of closed the chapter on being a full-time patient. And so now we're back to like reintegrating to you know, very walking city, a city with traffic and terrible winters, mm-hmm. and figuring out what we want to do for work and school and life and family planning. And it's hard because everything looks and feels different now. So in addition to, as Patrick mentioned, all those amazing supporters we've had, I think also being a part of this huge trauma where you feel like Boston's never forgotten about us. And I love going somewhere and seeing a Boston Strong singer sticker on the back of a city bus or a Boston Strong t-shirt somewhere. Like, you just feel like people are still rooting for you. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that motivation becomes internalized and we get up and we try again the next day. And I think that's where our specific trauma differs from a lot of individual or more anonymous traumas, is that we've had this incredible, unbelievable support that's continued 5 years later. You know, people haven't forgotten about us. It hasn't tired.
Personal and public support.
Absolutely.
You know, obviously, Monday is the Patriots Day, the day of the Boston Marathon, the fifth anniversary of these events. Your book, Rescue and Jessica, focuses on an 11-year-old Jessica, mm-hmm. A girl who has gone through her own amputation that kind of parallels yours in the, yep. in the timing of it, the way it works, but not related to the marathon at all.
Right.
How did you guys decide to do it that way?
Well, we knew we did not want to talk about the bombing. I mean, that was just right off the bat. We both agreed. And we just feel like it was a couple horrible, hateful seconds, and it doesn't deserve any more of our collective attention. And what does deserve our attention is everything that happened once those bombs went off, starting with the first responders that rushed to our side and all the help we received from then until now. In regards to the age of Jessica, that was help from our publishers, and it's kind of a funny story because in one of our first meetings they said, so how old did you envision yourself? And I'm a nurse. I'm very like scientific, black and white. And I said 32, because that's how old I was when that part of the story was happening. And they kind of were like, well, it's a little odd to have a main character of a children's picture book be a grown up. And they were worried that it wasn't going to be as relatable as it could be. And
meaning not just as a commercial endeavor, but just in speaking to the child.
Yes.
And conveying what you wanted to get across.
Absolutely. Can we make this story more powerful and resonate with more children? And one way to do that was to make me, the technical word is a tween. So, which changed the story, and it changed what Jessica and Rescue do together. They weren't going to go into Mass General for a 12-hour shift on the T, right? Because she's a tween. And also, it kind of wrote Patrick out because Jessica's not going to be married as a tween. So,
I got cut.
Patrick got cut.
It happens. It happens in Hollywood. It happens apparently in the cutthroat children's book business, right?
Yeah.
Happens both.
I will
them.
Say Patrick does make a few cameos.
He's the brother.
He is my kid brother. Yeah. Can you recognize
the
glasses?
Yeah, I saw the glasses. Yeah. It was all there.
Yeah.
I got to say, it's a really nicely done book because it's written gently and simply, but it's never condescending. Mm-hmm. There's not a moment at which you feel you're being preached at or talked down to, mm-hmm. I think. I thought that was, as father of two young children, I thought that there was something really wonderful about that. If I'm not mm-hmm. mistaken, you specialized in psychology. Is mm-hmm. that right? How do you process the importance of Rescue in thinking about the way in which you have at least been trained to deal with people and their emotional state?
For us, Rescue is the embodiment of all these people who have come into our lives to support us. Their support of us has just been incredible. And he is that unconditional love, the loyal companionship that we have found from humans. He has been for Jess. He has been for us. And kids know that instinctively. Humans get that. They know that dogs have this special place in our lives. And so when kids see Rescue and Jessica out and about, their eyes just light up. You know, they're so fascinated by this dog with this bright red cape in a place where you don't usually see dogs. And they want to know everything. What does he eat? What does he do for Jess? Where does he sleep? How does he play? And it's therapeutic just to talk to them about Rescue and all the ways that he's comforted us. So he's a perfect steward for the themes that we've tried to elucidate. He's a perfect steward for people with disabilities, that we don't have to just see the trauma or the victimization of someone, but instead see how love is still alive in their lives, companionship, all the obstacles that they can overcome as this really dynamic duo.
And for those listeners that can't see what we're like in studio, the two of you are sitting across from me a little bit. You guys have been looking down at Rescue. He's sitting, or lying, I should say, totally chill. Yep. There. He has not uttered a word. I'm very impressed. It's more than I can say. We have a call from Thomaston, Georgia. Deanne is on the line. She has a story about her Rescue equivalent.
Hi, David.
Hiya, Deanne. Tell us about your dad's dog.
My dad actually rescued Harley from the pound, and he trained her himself to be his service dog, his little sidekick. He had muscular dystrophy, and I always said my dad was my hero. My hero was on four wheels, and his sidekick had four paws and fur. Mm. He had such a better life because of Harley and everything that she helped him with. He taught her how to open doors, and she would go on daily walks with him when we lived in Florida, and she was always there with him. He was a happier person because of Harley. And, I mean, I love this children's book, the idea of this, because, you know, really – these rescue dogs that help people with disabilities are like their heroes and their sidekicks. And it's so important that we realize this and what an important relationship that these dogs have with those with disabilities and they get them, that have them. And I love this. I love everything about this.
Well, Deanne, thank you so much for that moving a tribute to Harley, your dad's best friend in Black Lab, service dog. Jessica Kensky, there's a moment in the book where your mini-me learns that she's going to lose her second leg.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly, Rescue clambers into her bed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only way she goes to sleep.
Yeah.
How closely that scan what happened in your life?
Oh, I remember that moment so clearly. You know, losing my left leg was a sudden, unexpected thing, but losing my right leg was a long, drawn-out kind of thing hanging over my head, and it was very planned. And when I went in for that second amputation, my parents were there, my in-laws were there, my sister was there, my brother-in-law was there. And I remember it being so weird because I rolled out of the OR and came into the recovery area, and there was now this enormous gap at the end of my bed. And that's just how I felt. I felt like I had lost so much in so many ways, you know, hope, my future, our plans. And to have Rescue jump up and fill that gap literally, you know, and figuratively was just what I needed in that moment. I don't think anyone could have done or said anything. I don't think there was any medication or drip, you know, that could have brought that comfort in that moment. And I think that as humans, we try to find all these ways to get these feelings or cover up these emotions, and we can do them in some pretty unhealthy ways. And I think dogs are such – all animals, really, but I'm biased to dogs. Dogs are such a healthy way to do it. Like your caller mentioned, you know, it got her dad focused. It got him out. He had a routine of walking. Like, it's such a great intervention that, you know, from a medical perspective, is pretty benign. It's not a surgery. Mm-hmm. It's not a drug. It's not, you know, a device.
But it's huge.
But it's huge.
To you as a human being, it's huge.
And it's immediate.
Right.
And it's not just felt by the individual who's paired. It's felt by their partner, by their family, by their community. I mean, Rescue's become, in our survivor group, he's kind of become the mascot. He's been there since the very early days. And people light up when they see him.
Jess really believes that North Korea could denuclearize if Kim Jong-un had a service dog, because they have such amazing companionship.
And if we tweet that out to the right folks, then
yes.
You get there. Patrick Downs, you went through what in any other conversation would be the most – would obliterate all other discussion. It is a traumatic thing that you went through as well. There is a book about Jessica's circumstance and about Rescue. Has Rescue been such a boon to you that it's helped you as well? Have there been moments when you've said, good Lord, I'm going through this trauma me here, and I almost don't have capacity to process even this woman I love, the trauma she's going through?
We very early on realized that Jess was in for a long road, and as a couple needed to, and as a family needed to harness all the resources we had to take care of Jess and help her decide how to regain a quality of life. The moment we met Rescue, he was so joyful and playful and made Jess light up that myself, Jess's father and sister, who were there to see it happen, laughed in a way that our bodies had forgotten what it felt like to be that joyful. And he has continued to be that sort of support for us. When Jess and I have had to go and speak with surgeons about all the different options that lay in front of her, we would go back to our room at Walter Reed or here in the Boston area. We'd cuddle with him. We'd take him out to play. He has been therapeutic for all of us as we've processed all of the nuances and complexities of the last number of years.
And in just the few minutes we have left, tell me a little bit about what the process of writing the book did for you and to you, each one.
When we were at Walter Reed and having really dark days, this was the one thing we could work on. We'd work on it for a half hour. We'd kick some ideas around. We would throw edits back to our agent, Clelia Gore. She'd throw things back at us. And we just had a blast with it, imagining how we could communicate the beauty of Rescue to children in a language that worked for them. And it's been, even as if this never saw the light of day, it was so therapeutic for us.
Jessica?
Yeah, if this was not a fun project from start to finish, we absolutely would have dropped it along the way, because we dropped a lot of important things like paying bills and responding to emails. Because depression, you know, doesn't usually make you a really productive person. But this was always fun. I think channeling Rescue, giving him – I know he has a personality and thoughts – Patrick knows, but to get to think them through and put them down on paper was just fun and playful. And I think it also tapped into my experience as a nurse and Patrick's experience as a psychologist. We got to use a little bit of our professional teaching too. And so it was just a great, I don't know, marriage of skills and talents.
We've got about 45 minutes left. If there were a blinking subterranean author's message, what do you want a kid? What do you want an 11-year-old Patrick, 11-year-old Jessica, to take from this, whether or not they've been through such a trauma?
That loyal companionship can help you overcome anything. That despite whatever obstacles you're facing in your life, if you have a dog or a human by your side who loves you unconditionally, that's all that counts.
If I had to pick one or two things, I would say for some kids to be able to see themselves or their family in this story, mm-hmm. and to normalize some of it and to open the door for them to share their own. But also for some kids that aren't exposed to these things, I want this equipment and these bodies to become normal.
Well, Jessica Kensky and Patrick Gowns, thank you for sharing your extraordinary story today. Thank you for providing some uplift too. And thanks for talking about your new children's book, Rescue and Jessica, A Life-Changing Friendship. Thank you. Thank you both, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. One other note, On Point would like to correct the record. In a segment on April 5th about teen vaping, we played a clip from a YouTube video and described the video blogger as a teenager. At the time the YouTube video was recorded, she was in fact 33 years old. We regret the error. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.